The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Max here in the spare room, sprightly and awake. Barry Glendenning. I can see you, Barry. How are you?
I'm in the doghouse to your spare room.
And why is that, Barry?
Well, you know why, Max. I got slightly pissed yesterday while we were doing the watch-along.
Yes.
Well, before the watch-along, during the watch-along, and after the watch-along.
Mm-hmm.
And I can already tell by the big grin on your face that you have plenty to say about it. So get it out of the way and let's crack on.
Producer Jonathan and I were messaging each other during the game.
I had a feeling you would be all right.
At which the suggestion was made, perhaps you had some sort of intravenous drip below the below the table.
It's been a while. I needed a blowout.
Fair enough.
Unfortunately, I chose to have it on the day when I was kind of working. Technically, I was off yesterday. So.
Okay. Now, do you know what, though? It was a great reminder of what it's like to watch football in the pub, though. That was the thing. There's always one person in the pub who just will not shut up and is talking really loudly and is constantly telling you that they're not drunk. And in many ways, that was a wonderfully nostalgic moment for me. It's not something I've experienced for at least 2 months, like a lot of us.
And I'll tell you what else there always is, Max. There's always one knobhead who, the day after you've disgraced yourself in the virtual pub,
yeah,
watching the game,
yeah,
who reminds you of the excruciating minutia of every single little thing you did wrong.
Okay,
and I have three or two of them here, you and producer Jonathan.
Okay, just so my final word on this. The greatest
moment.
It's
not going to be your final word.
It is.
Word,
no, I promise it is. The best moment was on the Google Hangout yesterday when Jonathan and I just needed to have a quick chat. And so Philippe left and we were waiting for you to leave, but you didn't know how to hang up the Google chat. So it was your finger just going towards the laptop, various speeds. And eventually you just closed the laptop. That was all you could do, was close the computer. And then we couldn't tell if you were still there or not because you didn't log out at all.
Well, funnily
anyway,
enough,
yeah,
I was doing this in the kitchen, right? I usually go in my room, but I was in the kitchen. And when I woke up this morning, the laptop I'd been using was plugged in beside my bed. And I opened the lid and the first thing I saw was the Google Hangout. So I had this moment of horror where I thought that you, Philippe, and producer Jonathan may have spent all night just listening to me sleep.
I mean, I don't have that many better things to do right now, but even still. Hey, a tiny bit of feedback, Barry. Aina, I think, E-A-N-N-A.
That's the Irish for Enda. Perfect, okay. Pronunciation by you, Max.
Thank you. I'm an Irishman living in Sweden, as my girlfriend is Swedish. On hearing that Barry misses the pub, I feel a little guilty, able to inhale a few pints most weekends in the pub. Would Barry consider moving to Sweden? I mean, given what you've just heard in the last 5 minutes, I imagine you don't want him to. But could Barry say hello to Lisa, as she loves his spoken word? Thanks.
Oh, hello, Lisa in Sweden. I would love to join you for a pint sometime. Although I believe pints in Sweden are incredibly expensive, so Aina and Lisa may have to get the beers in.
And finally, Christian says, I realise Barry isn't a performing monkey. Well, you say that. however, could you get him to say, go to sleep, Elva, in his soothing tones to try and get my two-year-old and subsequently the rest of the house a good night's sleep obliged?
Go to sleep, Elva. Mummy and Daddy are tired. Go to sleep and let them sleep.
Thanks, Barry. Right, part two will begin in just a moment. Philippe Auclair, Paul Doyle will join us in just a second as we look back on the 1982 World Cup semi-final, France v Germany, the night of Seville. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's look back at the 1982 World Cup semi-final, France v Germany, the night of Seville, one of the great World Cup games. And we'll do it with Paul Doyle and Philippe Auclair. Bonjour, Philippe.
Bonjour, Max. Ça va?
Ça va bien. Paul, how are you doing?
Yeah, all good.
Tell us why you chose this game, because this was your choice.
Yes, it was. Apologies for that, Philippe. I didn't know you were going to be here. I didn't deliberately inflict it on you.
Thank you very much. Yes, thanks to you, I had to relive not 90 minutes, but much longer than that of the worst possible pain I've ever gone through. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, obviously I chose it because it's a brilliant match, and it's one that if you do have to rewatch a match from the past, I think this one is a particularly entertaining one to rewatch, because it like a good movie, it's just as good almost the second time. And it's got real high quality, very high pace, lots of tension, drama, and of course some wonderful heroes and villains, and it defined eras for both countries, really. So it was wonderful.
Philippe, you have watched this game twice in your life.
Yes.
Once live when it happened on the family farm.
Correct.
And last night in front of me and a slightly intoxicated Barry.
That's very unfair.
Well,
I'd say it's very fair.
Tell us about your feelings of the game at the time and whether they changed at all watching it again.
The game at the time, no, they haven't, because to be absolutely honest with you, I don't think I've still digested that game. Therefore, I feel exactly the same about it as I did at that time. Watching it again actually confirmed what Paul was saying, that it had been truly one of the great games of football played at the World Cup, or actually anywhere else for that matter. And in fact, I was that surprised me a little bit. But at the time, it was more about the idea, the dream of going to a first World Cup final, the nature of the adversary, and what happened during the game. I was in a state of exaltation during the game, and also a state of absolute despondence afterwards, that honestly I have never been in for any other game in my life, and I don't think I ever will if we ever play football again. Emotionally, it was the most draining and most exhilarating game I've ever watched, and I entirely agree with Paul. I think it defined a whole era of football for France, and I think it actually defines international football for the French public. Even people, young people who have lived through the successes of 98 and 2000 and 2018, everybody knows about this game. We don't have much of a football culture in France, but this game is the absolute foundation of the way we perceive the game in our country. So it's that important. And this is, I felt like that at the time, and watching it again with you, confirmed, yes, that we had every reason to choose that game, has been absolutely typical of what we thought and hoped of a game, and also perhaps as well why we sometimes we might sound a little bit disappointed with the successes of the modern French team, which I know surprises everybody, but it's because we think of that one, which we think was better and played better football. And I think after watching the game, guys, I don't think you will disagree with me on this one.
Just to set the scene for these two coming into this game, as you said, Paul, about France being in the international wilderness, you know, from the 62 World Cup to the Euros in 1980, France qualified for two of those World Cups and none of the Euros. They actually missed out on 1980 because of a 2-0 defeat in qualifying to the eventual Group 5 winners, Czechoslovakia. The opening goal was a penalty from Antonín Panenka, who did a Panenka. Michel Hidalgo had coached the team since 1976. They got knocked out in the group stages at the 78 World Cup. This was his second attempt at a major tournament. They were known for this kind of champagne football, France, and we saw that in the game. West Germany, on the other hand, World Cup runners-up in 66, third in 70, champion 74. They won the Euros in 72 and in 80. 2 weeks before this game, they played in a game which went on to become known as the Disgrace of Gijón, where Germany needed to win to qualify for the second group stages. They played Austria, who'd won their first two games. Germany went 1-0 up in the 10th minute. Both teams wasted time for the rest of the game, which meant both of them went through. And then Algeria went out. Algeria had beaten Germany in the first group game, becoming the first African team to beat a European team at the World Cup, which was a huge upset. One outlet called it the greatest World Cup upset since North Korea beat Italy in 66. They lost to Austria, then beat Chile in their final game the day before Germany played Austria. And that was why games, the final group game was changed. So they were played at exactly the same time for tournaments following that. So fans at the disgrace of Hijo absolutely lost it. The Spanish fans were chanting Algeria, Algeria. Algerian fans waved banknotes at players. One West Germany fan actually burned their national flag in protest. The German team were pelted with eggs when they got back to their hotel. They retaliated with water bombs. Commentators on both German and Austrian football urged their audiences to change the channel and watch something else. The local newspaper printed the match report in the crime section, which is hilarious, isn't it? So you say going into this game, I suspect, Philippe, everybody was behind France.
Yeah, it was absolutely just the same way that even though because I don't want to spoil, I mean, don't listen if you don't want to, you know, to, things to be spoiled for you, but everybody was behind Italy in the final, even though Italy had beaten one of the greatest Brazilian sides of all time. Everybody was against the Germans. It became the rallying point. The whole world hated Germany, or I should say West Germany at the time. And I certainly was no exception. I left aside my the some of the language that I used on that night, and that I might actually have passed through my lips last night as well, was not the language of a proud cosmopolitan internationalist. It was awful, but it had been a disgrace. It had been an absolute disgrace. One thing. It's a detail I know, but it's sometimes, you know, people always refer to the carré magique of the magic square of or the magic quadrant of Michel Hidalgo, the French manager. And Paul, you were talking about Luis Fernandez coming into it, but the first carré magique was the one that we saw in that particular game, which, you know, is a bit ridiculous when you think about, you know, the way you can have a midfield with three number 10s and a number 8, which is basically what we had. But the first magic square was the one that we saw in that particular game. And which produced some of the most exquisite football that I think we've ever seen on the World Cup pitch. But there you go.
Yeah, I think mentioning how disliked Germany were, it's worth pointing out that they even disliked themselves. There was terrible infighting within the German camp even before the tournament started. In fact, Toni Schumacher asked to leave the pre-tournament training camp because he couldn't stand the debauchery that was going on all around him with the likes of Paul Breitner apparently leading it. And of course, Bernd Schuster, who I mentioned earlier, who was the one midfield creator that Germany had, who would have been of a, you know, comparable to Platini and Giresse and the likes, and who had led Germany to victory in the 1980 European Championships, wasn't playing because he fell out with Breitner and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, and the manager had no control over any of these players. He was a very weak manager. And of course, but it wasn't all particular harmony in the French camp either, because one of the reasons they had no midfielders on the bench.
Carry on.
According to Jean-François Larios.
It's not according to Jean-François Larios, it's a fact, Paul, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's a fact that their romantic style of play wasn't confined to the pitch. Larios took that spirit off the pitch with one of the players' wives, apparently.
Oh, you can say who it was, because everybody knows it. Well, it's in Jean-François Larios' book. So,
hasn't been sued. But he became too friendly with Michel Platini's wife when they were teammates at Saint-Étienne. So he played in the first match against England and didn't play again in the tournament because they just couldn't be on the same pitch together. And So when the Genie got injured and they needed to bring on a substitute, Larios would have been the perfect man to bring on if he hadn't started. But of course, Battiston came on instead and got clobbered by Schumacher. So their romance led to that brutality.
So Germany go 1-0 up in the 17th minute. Pierre Littbarski, youngest player in the Germany team with the goal, a lovely player as well.
Yeah.
France equalise with a penalty, Michel Platini scoring it 10 minutes later. No more goals in normal time, but the second half comes the incident that we've alluded upon. Patrick Battiston, who'd only just come on, is played through by Platini, tries to flick it over Toni Schumacher, the West Germany keeper. Arguably should have scored, but then gets absolutely clattered by Schumacher. Battiston had two teeth knocked out, three cracked ribs, damaged vertebrae, had to have oxygen on the pitch, later slipped into a coma. Interestingly, later in the commentary, Barry Davis says, no concussion there on Battiston. You're like, no, he's in a coma, mate. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, it's an unbelievable. It was a moment that even if you've never watched this game, you will have seen. But it's the most famous moment of this game.
Well, it had been quite a bad tempered game, and Toni Schumacher, as his known real name, Harold, he had been as bad tempered, if not more bad tempered, than anyone. So he'd already gone in on Platini, left one in on Didier Six, who Aston Villa fans of a certain age will remember, no doubt. And shortly before this incident, Platini had taken a shot which had gone wide and into the crowd behind the goal, and they refused to give the ball back to Schumacher. And when they eventually did give it back, he shaped as if to throw it back in to them, you know. So he was really simmering throughout this game, and then it culminated with this incident where he took out Battiston.
Just to add to that, after he shaped to throw the ball at the crowd, somebody threw a bottle at him. So from a section where there were a lot of French fans. So that probably got his dander up even more.
The referee afterwards said he didn't see it. He was watching the ball moving towards the goal. The assistant told him he thought it was unintentional. A goal kick was given. You do think, obviously now, I mean, we said watching it yesterday, like, none of us, I don't think, are fans of VAR, but just for that one moment, I'd have loved it to be there. A journalist told Schumacher after the match that Battiston had lost teeth, to which he replied, "If that is all that's wrong, tell him I'll pay for the crowns." He did later apologise to Battiston, but said he'd do the same again if he had to. It was the only way to get the ball, was a quote. A French newspaper did a poll to find out the least popular person in France. Schumacher was top and Hitler was second. It's interesting that it is so... I mean, I'm trying to think if there's a more famous foul in football.
I suppose you could argue Zinedine Zidane's headbutt on Marco Materazzi, but certainly I was 9 when this game was played. I remember watching it, and I remember absolutely being totally horrified. It was the most violent act of brutality I had ever seen in my life up to that point. And I'm kind of struggling to think of any worse I've seen on a sporting pitch since, and none spring to mind. I mean, I will never forget that. And I thought, and Michel Platini as well thought, that Battiston was dead.
Yep.
And when he was put on the stretcher, he had one arm hanging over the side of the stretcher, and Platini was holding his other hand and sort of kissed his hand and laid his arm across his chest as if, you know, he was a dead man being carried off on his shield. It was quite astonishing. So, yeah, I can't think of a worse act of brutality. Maybe Ben Thatcher's elbow on Pedro Mendes was pretty bad.
I would say Goicoechea's on Maradona was perhaps, in terms of pure aggression, but from a goalkeeper, there was actually a less famous one, of which Klinsmann was the victim. It was Bosnić on Klinsmann was also an absolutely awful one back in 1992, I think. It was absolutely terrible in the not yet to be Premier League. I think we should have a word for not the referee, because I think the referee actually had a great game that day. But his assistant, Mr. Bob Valentine, because he didn't cover himself in glory, but it wasn't the first time in this tournament, was it, Paul?
No, it wasn't. He was the referee of the aforementioned West Germany-Austria game. Not that there was a lot he could do about that, because you can't force people to play. But he was Scottish, of course, and... Scottish officials, France didn't have much luck with Scottish officials back in those days. You won't remember one of them. I'm sure you do remember one of the greatest bits of commentary ever about a Scottish referee called Ian Foot on French TV.
Monsieur l'arbitre, vous êtes un salaud!
Yeah. which translates as a dear referee or Mr. referee, you are a bastard. which was after he gave Bulgaria a penalty against France in the tournament. But Charles Korver, who was the Dutch referee, he had such a good game in that semi-final that he the referee's assessor, who was a Soviet guy, the Soviet guy who refereed the 1962 World Cup final, was the referee's assessor that day, and he gave him 9.5 out of 10, which was the highest mark given to any referee in the whole tournament.
In the second half, France batter Germany, don't they? And in extra time, they go 3-1 up in extra time.
Don't forget the Amoros shot and on the bar as well, and the fact that Battiston. I mean, you know, he might, of course, France might not have had a proper defensive midfielder, but Battiston probably should have scored before he was upended by Tony Schumacher as well, and the ball went wide, but he had a whole goal to aim at, and they absolutely battered the Germans. Which is, I mean, surprising actually is the physical freshness of some of these players, because the match was absolutely unrelenting. Perhaps not the kind of crazy tempo that we're used to these days with people sprinting, but the tempo was, the actual rhythm was relentless. There was no pause. Another thing which we will have noticed is that it was quite a violent game, but there was very little shithousery. There was no tactical fouling whatsoever. And when actually Tony Schumacher upended Battiston, one of the most remarkable things is that Schumacher was able to get away with it from the French players. Nobody went to him and started to threaten him and so on. He walked away, but I think maybe they were more concerned with you know, the well-being of their teammate than they were with the culprit of the aggression.
Well, Schumacher said since that it was the only time in his life he was ever scared, and that was the reason he didn't go over to inquire about Battiston's welfare. So we were left with the image of him sort of placing the ball on the edge of the six-yard box, standing there chewing gum with his hand on his hip, looking as if he didn't give a damn. But he claims, or has since claimed, that he was too scared to go over because all the French players were around Battiston, and he thought they might attack him if he went over.
In extra time, Philippe, Trezor puts France ahead. Lovely volley. Giresse doubles their lead with a beautiful strike. Wonderful footballer, Giresse. At this point,
and probably the most, you would say, until perhaps the famous shot of Zidane standing on his knees, scoring against Brazil, the most iconic shot, and for once you can use the word iconic without any reservation, is the goal celebration by Alain Giresse, which is with Marco Tardelli. Actually, it's probably the World Cup of the best two celebrations, Marco Tardelli and Alain Giresse. It is a moment of pure joy, pure exhilaration. And this at this time, honestly, when Giresse scores, until then, I remember how I feel. And we think it's the Germans. They're going to come back. They're going to come back. And then Giresse scores, and we think they're not going to come back. That's it. We have it. We're in the final. And which is, oh God, I can't carry on again. take over from here.
But it's interesting. It's interesting, Philippe, because as Paul mentioned, and it's a boring phrase, game management. But a 3-1 up, the French keep on playing. Which is just is bizarre.
But both teams kept on playing at every single point of this game. When the Germans were 1-0 up, they carried on playing. There was the cynicism that we saw in the physical confrontation was nowhere to be seen in terms of the football they wanted to play. Which is genuinely football from another time, another era. And by the way, France perhaps didn't have the kind of squad or the kind of team on the pitch at the time to do game management very well at all. We didn't have players who could put their foot on the ball and not do anything with it. On the other hand, you could also say maybe it went to our heads. The fact after going 2-1, we carried on playing, go 3-1, think, well, if you carry on playing, you know, attack is the best form of defense as far as we're concerned. And it took, you know, something rather special. I mean, even though perhaps the most important goal was going back to 3-2, which happened very quickly. And that was lack of concentration and so forth. And then afterwards, you've got, you know, this thing, this doubt at the back of your mind saying, oh, no, they've cancelled that goal so quickly. And then, yeah, perhaps but the goals were excellent. And Fischer's goal is absolutely magnificent. There's nothing you can say about that.
Rummenigge makes it 3-2 with a brilliant centre forwards finish. He'd just come on. It's cruel because France had to use their second substitution to replace their first. They couldn't bring any fresh legs on. And then Klaus Fischer scores this overhead kick equaliser, which is a brilliant finish, isn't it? Let's talk about the penalty shootout. Germany win it 5-4. Maxime Bossy and Didier Six missing for France. Uli Stielike missed for Germany, but Horst Hrubesch scored the winning penalty.
Horst Hrubesch being the most German-looking German on the field. It was kind of fitting.
Jean-Luc Ettore, the French keeper, 5'8". Only three players on the pitch who were shorter than him. Chris Vokes from The Sportsman watched along and tweeted, "Good of France to give a run out to a keeper who had seemingly never faced a penalty kick in his entire life beforehand." Thought he was trying to recreate an ice hockey penalty for a minute there.
France had terrible problems with goalkeepers all throughout. They used three different goalkeepers in qualifying, all of whom performed terribly. And they ended up going for Ettore, who had hardly played, who hadn't played in the qualifiers at all, and he was just drafted in just before the World Cup. And he showed throughout, before he even got to the semi-final, he showed an amazing ignorance of football history. Because during the group, they played Czechoslovakia. And they conceded, they were 1-0 up, and they conceded a penalty with a few minutes to go. And who, you alluded to it earlier, who is the one player in the whole history of football that you don't dive early when he's taking a penalty? Well, he dived early and Panenka put it the other way.
The aftermath of this game then, Germany went on to lose in the final to Italy, not Brazil out in the second group stage. France put out the kids in the third place playoff against Poland and lost 3-2. Platini said later of this game, "This was my most beautiful game. What happened in those 2 hours encapsulated all the sentiments of life itself. No film or play could ever recapture so many contradictions and emotions. It was complete, so strong. It was fabulous."
The French manager, Michel Hidalgo, who died recently, we spoke about on a previous pod, he said, "Before the match, I had a team of men who, when they put the shirt on, looked bigger than their real size. After the game, they looked like a team of school kids. They were all crying like children in the dressing room. We had to force them to undress and get them into the showers. They were inconsolable."
As a result of it taking so long to get those French players into the showers, they had to be forcibly showered. Their flight had to be delayed. So they got to the airport later at the same time as the German team. And so there was a big standoff at the airport until the referee arrived. And apparently the French players claimed they saw the referee laughing and joking with the Germans. And so that's when Jean Tigana apparently took particular exception to that and had to be forcibly restrained from going to attack the referee in the airport. The referee, by the way, who France had lobbied to get appointed for that match.
Oh, really?
Because he was originally down to do the World Cup final, but when four European teams reached the semis, they decided they better give the final to a South American. So France said, "Okay, well, how about Charles Corver? We get him to referee us because we think he's the best." The fact that he had a French father may also have influenced their thinking.
Philippe, it's interesting the impact on French football, this, isn't it? 2 years after this, France won Euro 84. 6 months after that, construction was started on Clairefontaine, the National Football Centre. That was finished in 1988, at which point they started taking in boys between 13 and 15 from the Paris suburbs. That brings on winning the World Cup in 98 and Euro 2000 with several graduates, the latter from Clairefontaine. They were runners-up at the 2006 World Cup. They won in 2018, lost the 2016 final. Because you were complaining about watching this game last night, and I said to you as an Englishman, how many tournaments have you won in your lifetime,
I would also add to the list, Max, 1986 and the semi-final lost against the Germans again. But after one of the great, the other great games in the history of the World Cup, which is the 1-0 win against Brazil in Guadalajara. And as you say, but the foundations had been laid already. And they had been laid, amazingly, by Stefan Kovac, which people have forgotten, about before Michel Hidalgo came to get that role as a team national manager. And it was then a progression, a constant progression, which was also, by the way, mirrored in the way that French clubs' performances in the European Cup started to improve towards the late 80s and certainly early 90s. So, yeah, it was part of this move forward. And this team was really, I mean, how important it is in our history, and I say, and I keep saying that, it's a game that is more important than some victories in our history, is the fact when we did a special edition with France Football. I think it's the only special edition we did, which was, like a celebration or something like 25 years later, something like that, where we had actually a DVD of the game with the magazine. It's the only time we've done it in our history. It was for a defeat. It was for Sevilla 1982. That tells you.
Is it hard to watch Platini being a beautiful footballer?
No, at all. He remains my favorite French footballer of all time, regardless of all the horrors I've been writing and saying about him as a UEFA and especially FIFA figure. He remains, I think, the most important French player of all time. And I say, people will say Zidane and the two goals in the final of the World Cup, which have a symbolic value and so forth, but I wouldn't say that. Platini was much, much more than that. He was already there in 78 when that team, when you started to see this team starting to coalesce, which already had Marius Trezor and other people like that, and who were completely robbed by the referee in their games against Argentina in 1978. It was already a beautiful team then, and which then progressed. But Michel Platini was the rock around which, with the kernel around which the fruit kind of grew. This is the wrong image, I know, but you understand what I mean. He was there throughout this whole progression. He brought to France also a winner's mentality that perhaps we didn't have beforehand, and which he brought perhaps because of his experience in Italy. Michel Platini, don't forget, was three times Serie A's top goal scorer in an age when Serie A had the best defensive sides on the planet, playing from midfield. The guy was a genius with the ball at his feet. He was a poet. There are things he does, and when it was in this particular game against Germany, which if today you go out of your seat again, it's the vision, it's the technique, it's the elegance, it's the time he's got on the ball, and also the lack of physicality, which even enhances his qualities. He's the greatest. I mean, you got a far too long an answer. You know, you were just asking a quick question, but I absolutely love Michel Platini. For me, as a player, nobody will ever come close in French football. Nobody.
Would you say the reason that these players have such a legacy is that they laid down the blueprint of the France to come?
That, and also they stayed together for quite a long time. Don't forget that, because there was the qualification for this World Cup. Then there was the Euro 84, then there was the World Cup 1986. So this generation of players stays together around Michel Platini. Our luck was that they were more or less all of the same age, of the same age group, so they could grow together. There's one thing I'd like to mention, and we talked about it very briefly yesterday when we were watching this game together, is that some of the things which have become cliches about the French team of the recent past. One of them in particular is the team of all colors, a team that draws its inspiration from players who come from, all over the world, basically. And in fact, you realize that, I mean, which is one thing that people who know French football have always known, which is that French football is a football of immigration, has always been. It was thus since the 1930s when we had a fantastic team in the 1930s, which was composed of Polish emigres, Jewish Hungarians and Austrians who had fled the rise of fascism and Nazism. We had people who were from North Africa. We had people from the Italian immigration and so on. And in that particular team in 1982, I've actually made my list here. In the starting lineup, there are two players from the West Indies, originally from the West Indies, Gérard Janvion and Marius Trezor. There is Jean Tigana, who originally came from Mali, and if I'm not mistaken, arrived in France when he was 14 and first worked as a postman before people realized he was very good as a footballer. You've got people coming from the Spanish immigration following, fleeing Franco. That's Manuel Amoros. But you also had on the bench Gérard Lopez, Soler, and Castaneda. And then you have people coming from the Italian immigration, second or third generation, Ettore, Gengini, Michel Platini, of course, and Bruno Bellone, whom we would see in 1986. So it's also, you know, in your perception of the French national team, I think people can also see in this game that it's the first time this... it's not the first time, but perhaps the world should have become more aware of the fact that we were a far more diverse team, a European team, than any others. But we'd always had been. And funnily enough, it took 1998 and a victory for the rest of the world to realize something we had known from the very start, is that our football is a football of immigration and has been all the better for it.
Yeah, and I think France's greatest player before Platini, Raymond Kopa, I think his full name is actually Kopaczewski, isn't it? He shortened
Kopaczewski, Raymond Kopaczewski, absolutely. First generation Polish immigrant. Yeah. And the other great players of 1958, Roger Piantoni, Ujlaki, you hear the names, you can tell. You even had an Englishman whose name we called him Aston, but in fact it was Aston, as in Martin Aston, who played for Manchester United in 1968. And he was a French international in the 1930s.
If you look at Wikipedia, there are 18 World Cup games which have their own individual pages. They are, i.e., they're that important. And four of those are from the 1982 World Cup.
Wow.
This game, the disgrace of Gijon, Italy's 3-2 win over Brazil, which we covered on a previous pod, and Hungary's 10-1 win over El Salvador, which was another potential choice you put forward, Paul. Tell us why.
If you see the celebration after they score to cut the deficit to 5-1, half the team are ecstatic. Hooray, we've scored our first ever goal in a World Cup. And the rest of the team are running after him saying, calm down, you'll only make them angry. And they went on to lose 10-1. But them just being there was an amazing triumph because their country was ravaged by war at the time. And they were also severely undermined by corruption within their association. They only travelled with 20 players because officials, instead of a 22-man squad, because officials decided to bring two extra officials. They didn't have any tracksuits, balls, anything like that. But their players were particularly upset about the fact that on their country's appearance on the international stage, when they had a chance to show a positive side of their country rather than war, which was all that they were in the news for at the time, they didn't have any pennant to give to the teams, their opponents, before a match. And so the goalkeeper was particularly upset about this. So what he ended up doing, short of anything else, was he cut the bark off a tree near their training ground and scraped with a knife El Salvador onto it. And that's what he gave the Hungarian captain before the match.
That is unbelievable. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up any other business.
The Guardian Science Weekly podcast is exploring some of the crucial scientific questions surrounding COVID-19. From soap...
It does not matter how good your soap is, it is how you apply it on your hands.
...to social distancing...
The fact that we're doing this online means I'm unlikely to spread an infectious disease to you.
...to unlocking a lockdown.
If you ease off when your infections are still at a very high level, you're just going to maintain infections.
Listen to Science Weekly from The Guardian on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League met on Friday to try and work out what to do. There were no major announcements. There seems to be a consensus that playing games at neutral venues is unavoidable, but some want relegation removed as an option. More than one club is questioning whether Project Restart is realistic. The Crystal Palace chairman Steve Parish wrote an article in the Sunday Times saying, "I've seen all the proposals for training and travel, and while there are challenges, these proposals offer a level of protection to players, staff and officials that I believe will render Premier League football one of the safest places in society to coexist, much safer than a journey to the supermarket at present. And the more we can work out now, the better chance we have of coming out of this with the game we all love in a position to recover over time." But then Sergio Aguero told an Argentinian TV station this weekend that the majority of players are scared to resume play because they have children and families. There's going to be another meeting this week during which there should be some actual decisions made. Barry, you've had an idea emailed to you.
Yeah, a Canadian academic, a guy called Dr. Tim Walters from Okanagan College in British Columbia, he had a very, very long and interesting article published on the Sporting Intelligence website. But sort of in a nutshell, he's saying that the the big rush to get this season back up and running is because the powers that be want to get next season started on time. And his idea is to basically just abandon next season and then finish this season at a more leisurely pace that will make things safer for everyone. And he points out that you'd have 92 Premier League matches, 7 FA Cup matches, 17 Champions League ties. So that's 116 games. Throw in the Europa League, Football League, Women's Super League, Women's Champions League, and you're up to 269 games, which you could play out over the course of a year. The TV contracts, he says, they can be revised or extended because, and he makes what I think is an important point, that Premier League clubs are desperate not to have to pay back money to the TV companies, but the TV companies need football as much as football needs them right now. So there's no benefit for the TV companies in doing anything that might bankrupt football clubs. And I think it's quite an interesting idea. You know, you'd have 269 games played over a year, and people would be so much more interested in many of these games than they would be if they were being rushed out, you know, in over the course of 3 weeks, as is the current plan. And once again, Glenn Murray, I think, has been excelling himself at the moment. I saw him talking on BBC News earlier this morning, and while he seems happy enough to go with the flow, I definitely get the impression he is not, and he, I think he speaks for quite a lot of footballers, where he's not all that enthusiastic about the plan as it is at the moment, and, you know, getting the league finished as quickly as possible so we can start next season on time. Because and the one thing to remember is there will not be sporting events in front of big crowds for quite a long time. So, you know,
There were two polls over the weekend, one of them totally unscientific, which is the one I did on my Twitter feed, asking people who were football fans whether they wanted the game to resume even behind closed doors. And there were actually about 67-33 against the game resuming. That was my unscientific poll on Twitter. But there was one done by The Observer, in which football came at the very bottom of the activities that the public opinion wanted to resume. And in fact, 84% of people, I think, who were asked the question by populace, said 84% said that football shouldn't resume. And I think we're overplaying this great hunger for football. And can I just say, you know, Steve Parish, when he talks about the game we all love, he's talking about the Premier League. He starts with the Premier League and he ends with the Premier League. He's talking about nobody else. And that's a discourse that we are accepting, I think, far more too willingly at the moment, I think.
Elsewhere, two Cologne players and one physio have tested positive for COVID-19 and now going to quarantine for 14 days. The rest of the squad are continuing to train for the potential return of the Bundesliga. The date of the first game back, potentially the 19th or the 26th.
Perhaps worth noting as well that tonight, so Monday night, there is a new test of the players, which is seen in Germany as being absolutely essential, you know, for the decision to restart or not restart the Bundesliga season, because the decision has still got to be taken by the federal government. And the other thing as well, and that it's that the one of the teammates of the two players who've tested positive, that's Belgian midfielder Birger Verstraeten, has given an interview to Het Laatste Nieuws, in which he has said that the Bundesliga's behaviour had been, quote unquote, irresponsible. So very, very harsh words here, even if he slightly rode back from that position. But that's what he said at the time, and that must be indicative of the mood of the players within the Köln camp.
A deep breath, Barry. What's going on in Scotland?
Well, the top flight clubs in Scotland are going to have a Zoom conference today or tonight to basically discuss ending the season with immediate effect. That was an exclusive in the Daily Record today. And five of the clubs have said that they won't have enough players under contract to finish the season. And there's a suggestion that the Scottish season may be ended. And finishing it would release £7.5 million of prize money to be distributed among the various Scottish Premier League clubs. And elsewhere, the SPFL head, Neil Doncaster, has said he can't wait to see what's in this dossier of wrongdoing that Rangers keep saying they have. He says he has no idea what's in it, can't wait to see it. And he's been very critical of the vagueness of Rangers' allegations against him. So there'll be an extraordinary general meeting on the 12th of May to discuss this big conspiracy theory about the manner in which the Scottish lower leagues were ended and that mysterious Dundee vote.
Few more pieces of news for you from the US. On Friday, a federal judge threw out the unequal pay claim by players on the US women's national team, but allowed their allegation of discriminatory working conditions to go to trial. Molly Levinson, spokesperson for the defending world champion, said in a statement, "We are shocked and disappointed with today's decision, but we will not give up our hard work for equal pay. They are expected to appeal the ruling." Kevin De Bruyne has said he may have to consider his position at Manchester City if their two-year ban from European competitions is upheld. He said, "Once the decision is made, I will review everything. 2 years would be long, but in the case of 1 year, I might see." Dave Kitson has launched his bid to become the chief of the PFA. He's already hit a hurdle with Joby McEnough, Marvin Sordell, Marcus Bean all suggesting in The Guardian he would struggle to earn the confidence of black players after comments he made after the incident at Chelsea when Raheem Sterling was racially abused by members of the crowd. The day after that incident, Kitson was on TalkSport and he said, "I trawled through Sterling's Instagram feed this morning to find out that a lot of what he put on in his early days has now been deleted. And it was, look at my cars, look at my house, look at this bathroom, look at this, look at that, look at me. And that is going to antagonize people." He apologized this weekend to Raheem Sterling, saying, "Perhaps I used clumsy language, and for that I apologize. I admire Raheem for taking up the fight and saying, no, I'm not having this. And I agree with him, more needs to be done, and I'm prepared to do it." Darren Lewis of The Mirror said on Sky this weekend, "I'd have liked to have seen him come out and address the strong reaction to those comments at the time. Doing it now, he wants to run the organisation, of which a huge contingent of black players, former and current, it does not resonate with a lot of people. And I'm sure those people will be coming out to make their views clear."
I agree with what Darren Lewis said. And there are some other dubious posts on Kitson's social media accounts where he misidentifies several black players and likens one in his local Tesco to a Manchester United striker. And I think he has no chance of becoming head of the PFA. I think, you know, he's really shot himself in the foot. And Darren is absolutely correct. Why didn't he apologise at the time? Because this was quite a, I wouldn't say a scandal, but it was definitely grabbed a few headlines and made the news.
Finally, an exclusive in the paper from Ed Ahrens, Romain Molina and Alex Sismic. The president of the Haitian Football Federation has been accused of sexually abusing young female footballers at the country's national training centre, using his power and position to coerce players into having sex with him. Yves Jean-Bart, known as Dadu, has denied the allegations, saying they were clearly a manoeuvre to destabilise the FHF. The character of the president and his family, Philippe.
Yeah, just one thing to note, another thing to note in this absolutely horrendous story, which I think should make much more of a storm actually than it has. But maybe it's I think there are some new elements which will come to light very soon. Is the fact that Mr. Dadu or Jean-Bart has been recently re-elected, obviously unopposed, for a sixth consecutive term as Haiti FA chairman, when FIFA statutes are quite clear it should only be three as a maximum. But what was the way FIFA reacted to his re-election? It's a telegram of congratulations coming from Gianni Infantino. This was in February. And maybe FIFA, if they're so effusive about Mr. Jean-Bart's leadership of Haiti, could look at this one, particularly the Ethics Committee. Let's hope they do the same thing as they did for other situations, namely Afghanistan and Somalia, and that they look into the Haitian affairs.
Right, that will do for today's pods. Detective Wilson, Chapter 7. Which builds up to the finale, will be released as a separate pod tomorrow. We're giving it its very own episode as the story reaches a climax. Also, we may have talked quite a lot about the semi-final from World Cup 82, so those things put together means that we will put out Chapter 7 of Detective Wilson tomorrow, and we will be back on Thursday. Philippe, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Max. And even if I don't thank you for having to relive the agonies of Sevilla 1982.
Well, that is entirely Paul Doyle's fault. Paul, thanks for coming on. Nice to see you.
You too.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We will be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.